Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the IC Companies and Markets podcast. I'm Mark Robinson. I'm sitting in for Dan Jones, who's taking a well-deserved break at the moment. And I'm joined this week by my colleagues, Julian Hoffman, Gemma Slingo, and Jennifer Johnson. It's been a fairly sort of busy week, really, at least in terms of news on the market. This week, we're going to be looking at, well, we're going to be taking a trip down memory lane, at least for some of us, at any rate, because we'll be looking at some investor options to gain exposure to the Lloyd's market, courtesy of a new article that's been written by Julian. We're also going to be taking another look at some of the companies featured this time in the second installment of our AIM 100 review. Somewhat disparate at that, one of the companies engaged in professional translation services and the other two in human and animal health. There's been some Q3 updates from WPP and Meta platforms, so we're going to be musing on that a little later, given the likely or the possible future trajectory of advertising budgets. So we can look at that. Otherwise, there's been, no shortage of trading updates, and that's ahead of the short but intense reporting season for the 30 September year ends and half years. ASOS actually failed to report. They were due to publish their audited figures on Wednesday, and that obviously hasn't played very well with the market, feeding into existing anxieties. There's been one of the more heavily shorted stocks in London of late, which seems somewhat at odds with the fact that it was, once upon a time, it was the poster child for online or fast fashion. But the general feeling is that it may have failed to capitalize on trends that were established during lockdowns, and its turnaround plans are just simply taking too long. To be fair to ASOS, it's facing the same difficulties, the same headwinds that the industry is as a whole. It's faced with increased competition as well, shrinking discretionary incomes, and they've also blamed the weather, although I always tend to think that's a little bit spurious. At any rate, Frasers Group, they've been adding to its stake in the company, and it's going to fuel speculation that change may be at hand. We also saw an update from Unilever today, actually, which didn't find favor with the market. The consumer goods giant is definitely pulling in its belt, judging by the report, and it's ruled out any large-scale M&A activity in the future. It outlined a strategy which, amongst other things, includes a management overhaul. And perhaps the most interesting feature, though, is that it said that it was increasing focus on its big brands that account for the lion's share of the turnover. I think it's about 30 brands that account for 70% of revenues. And when I first read this, I thought this could be a vestige of the pandemic, when Unilever and some global peers, most notably Procter & Gamble, I think, they pared back a number of product lines in response to the existing supply chain disruption. That had the effect of actually supporting gross margins to a certain degree during that period. And also, these companies now, they're faced to a larger extent, well, they depend to a larger extent, really, on trusted brand names and brand loyalty. It's one of the moats associated with these types of companies, but they're now facing increased pressure from generic products in the market. Lastly, today there was a profits warning from Standard Chartered. The shares fell by about 10% on the market. That's a big warning for a company of that size, and it contributed to the weakness in the benchmark FTSE 100 index. Of course, the company's been hit by problems in the Chinese real estate market. It's not on its own there, and the talk is now that it's going to become increasingly vulnerable to a takeover again from this time from Abu Dhabi, one imagines. Julian, back in September when you were detailing Ashmore's full-year figures, I think you pointed to the fact that the emerging market sector had been banking really on a material weaker US dollar that would come to the rescue, but that hasn't quite panned out.
No, it hasn't. The dollar's going the other direction again, as it always does when there's a crisis. I mean, the figures themselves weren't that bad in the sense that they seemed able to capitalize on their net interest margin. And the thing that everyone's pointing to is the fact that their Chinese real estate write-downs are picking up.
Yeah.
And it's the same situation as with HSBC. You know, they've all been backing commercial real estate in China, and that market is going south very rapidly. In fact, there was talk today, wasn't there, that the biggest bond bankruptcy in China is again around the corner, when one of their developers has missed another coupon payment. So it's a very volatile situation. I mean, it's almost deprecating to call them emerging market, but you know, new markets are not proving to be a shelter for investors at the moment. Everybody looks to the dollar as soon as there's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, and given the deteriorating sort of global security situation as well, that's attracting dollar interest or safe haven interest as well. So that's, you know, given the negative correlation with emerging market growth, that's obviously a bit of a worry too. Okay, Julian is still with us, of course, and this week he's written a really interesting news analysis piece on Lloyd's markets. And for me anyway, it was quite a nostalgic view of the world as well, because it took me back to the days of Lon Rove, Tiny Roland, Bob Maxwell.
Yeah, horse brasses in pubs.
Exactly. BCCI.
another one. Yeah, we did our favourite corporate scandals of the 80s discussion yesterday, didn't we, really?
Yeah.
This is associated really with the Lloyd's market, which is what we're talking about. And the first thing anyone says who has any length of memory on this is the Lloyd's name scandal, where lots of individual investors found themselves often quite inadvertently being signed up as Lloyd's names by, you know, incompetent or unscrupulous financial advisors. And it was really, in those days, it was just as easy as, you know, signing a form and pledging your house. The reason why this has come up again is because investors seem to be looking again at the Lloyd's market for returns, because insurance rates have been going up for the last 22 quarters. It's almost a boom time, you could say, because you notice it in your car insurance. Anything you buy that has insurance at the moment is far more expensive than this time last year. And those hardening rates are encouraging investors to look again at the Lloyd's market as a source of regular returns. The main problem has always been access. So if you want to invest in the Lloyd's market, you need to have a certain amount of capital, which is quite high. The threshold is something like 350,000. You have to be able to invest, and it can't be any more than 10% of your total capital. So there's not a lot of people in the grand scheme of things who have that kind of money available. And you also have to pass the client suitability tests before you start investing in syndicates. So there's a lot of bureaucracy involved in getting into Lloyd's.
You said there's a potential IPO in the offing.
Well, this is where it becomes interesting. So as a proxy, people have tended to buy Beazley, which is a well-listed reinsurer, as a sort of proxy for investing in Lloyd's. But a potential IPO that's coming up in November is being launched by a company called FinSAC, which is a special purpose acquisition vehicle, which put together by a couple of ex-insurance executives. And they've been talking since the summer about getting a fund off the ground that will invest in the Lloyd's syndicates on behalf of investors. And it seems like this development is now closer. They've done a reverse takeover into something called London Innovation Underwriters, which is a specialist, you know, underwriting type company. And together, they're looking to raise $500 million to invest in a book of syndicates. And they're marketing this quite heavily towards retail investors, and for reasons which, you know, make kind of sense. You know, Lloyd's market returns are about, you know, averaging 10% annually at the moment, or have done for a long time, unless you get a massive string of disasters, which is what happened in 87 to 89. You had two hurricanes, you had the Exxon Valdez, you had the Piper Alpha rig blowing up. You can make money ahead of you know, the head of claims. I mean, that's how it works. And that that return perennially has been about 10%. So they're looking at ordinary investors to access the market, you know, at the same time as overcoming the barriers that there are to accessing Lloyd's. So it's quite an interesting possible proposition. It's just a question of whether the IPO gets definitively off the market next month, and what reception is going to get from investors, I think, is the other one, because there is a lot of folk memory around the Lloyd's market.
Yeah, it's bound to be closely followed as well. I remember going back to the Lloyd's name scandal as well. The government was eventually forced or decided to intervene, which created a great deal of controversy at the time. This is one the market will be looking at very closely, I would imagine.
It's been totally reformed. They actually had to pass an act of parliament to reform it.
Oh, okay. There we are.
So it's on less. It was a very much a gentleman's agreement type place, and now it's all sort of been more formalised, I think. And certainly the amount of capital buffer and safety ratios that you need in order to trade there has increased massively. So, it's a more regulated market than it ever was.
Okay, presumably that impacts returns though. But as you say, if they've been averaging 10% per annum over the long term, that's going to attract investor interest. I do recall that Henry Cooper was one of the names that was caught up in that original scandal. But
The boxer.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there, lots of people were. I mean, they won't thank me for saying this, and I hope they're not subscribers. But my old neighbours got caught up in it, and we ended up buying their field at a very knockdown price.
Oh, nice.
One can only hope that. I'm sure that they're in a far better situation now.
Yeah.
Than in the autumn of 1989.
Indeed. that was then and this is now. We're going to be moving on for a discussion with Gemma Slingo on RWS. It's a translation and records management company, I guess you'd say. So the shares dropped quite dramatically on the day prior to this broadcast. The company cited reduced activity in several of its markets, and it said that it's going to be missing revenue expectations. Gemma, you know this company backwards, actually. So, I mean, what was your take on the on yesterday's announcement?
I think we'd say it wasn't particularly surprising. So it might be useful just to cycle back to look at what RWS actually does, because it's one of the biggest names in the AIM 100, but not that many people have heard of it, really. So it has various divisions, but basically everything's focused around translation, as you said. So a lot of its revenue comes from technical translation. So that's work for things like pharmaceutical companies, law firms, where the translation has to be extremely accurate in order to convey the exact message. And patent translations is another big area of sales for them. So we'd seen it do pretty okay for a long time, RWS, but over the last couple of years, things have really gone downhill and it's developed this habit of disappointing investors. So last year, it came out on its capital markets day saying profits would be at the lower end of expectations. It did the same thing this year. And then, as you mentioned, just a few days ago, it published a trading update saying organic revenue was down and it was missing its sales targets. So I think investors by now are pretty used to some nasty shocks from the company, but that didn't stop shares going down by about a fifth on the day.
Yeah, earlier this year as well, I think the company said itself that it introduced a number of cost-saving initiatives that would lead to savings of about 10 million for the remainder of this year and 25 million into next year as well. At the same time, I think they announced a fairly hefty share buyback. Given the nature of the company's activities, I wonder, you know, is it really that easy for them to pare back costs? Because they, as a proportion of revenues, their fixed costs must be fairly high compared to a lot of companies.
I think you're right. Yeah, there is this question of whether they will just strip things back so much because of the profit pressures that actually the business as a whole will be diminished. And I think the real worry for investors has been on the demand side of things, really, because in its latest trading update, it cited sort of ongoing challenges, reduced activity in some markets, and it always has an excuse for why the activity is low, but it doesn't really seem to have any answers on how to re-energise it. So on the one hand, as you say, you've got these cost pressures and this need to strip back expenses, but also there are these big questions about whether demand is sustainable and whether it will bounce back as management keeps promising.
Yeah, I guess when you look at it, if you've had a fall away in global M&A activity, which we've seen, if we've had a fall away in activity within the league or fraternity, which we've seen as well, you're bound to have an overall reduction in demand for this type of work. So, I mean, there must be a correlation to general demand, at least within the broader advisory complex. But there we are, one to keep an eye on there as well. If we can move on now to another update, another unfavourable update as well with WPP. And Gemma, you've had a look at this one as well. And it falls into line with some comments that you made on a recently published feature called the Battle for Human Attention. What were WPP saying and what was the market reaction?
Yeah, so WPP, obviously a much bigger name, the big advertising agency. And it's not having a very easy time, as you might expect. So this morning, it trimmed its profit forecasts and its revenue outlook because of this pressure on ad spend. And it flagged in particular North America and China as being big issues. Actually, the market reaction wasn't too extreme, because I think just generally the sector's been under so much pressure. Investors have been worried for quite a while. So just having a look, shares are actually only down by 2% currently. So I think this sort of dread was probably ingrained in its share price.
Yeah, I mean, there's a broader story there as well, because I think whenever advertisers in trouble, it's never a good sign for the economy, probably even more so now given the type of advertising they're engaged in. So it's seen as a decent bellwether for the economy as a whole, because obviously companies will usually increase spending on ads when they're feeling positive, and they'll scale back during more challenging periods as well. And given the breadth of WPP's operations, I mean, that's possibly an even bigger problem there. It did say that it was having an investor day in January to outline its plans to drive growth. I mean, have you got any thoughts on how it might hope to achieve that in an unfavourable market?
So it seems to have a few different ideas. So one of the things it keeps mentioning is this, its attempts to streamline the company, simplify it to make, I think, because at the moment it's just got so many different moving parts, it's quite hard, I suppose, as an investor to figure out what's going on, but also to run it internally. But another big issue with WPP that investors have been talking about for a while is whether it's got a strong enough digital direction. So lots of its big peers were buying up digital advertising companies to sort of bolster that side of the business, whereas WPP is often associated with more traditional big ad campaigns. And there is this question of whether it can compete effectively in today's market. So I imagine people will be keeping quite a close eye on that as well.
No doubt at all. Actually, other people might be keeping a closer eye on it too, because that has been sort of linked with takeover speculation regarding its relationship with Blackstone and a company, Silver Lake, as well. So that's another name there that could be in play too. I mean, I guess that's a feature of the market at the moment. We're seeing quite a few profit shortfalls and increased distressed debt. The successive interest rate rises are actually seem to be having a profound effect in the economy now, and that could lead to consolidation throughout a number of sectors. Lastly today, we're going to have a look at a couple of companies that were also included in our latest AIM 100 rundown as well. Speaking to Jennifer Johnson about these. Jennifer, there's a couple of companies that you'd like to highlight, pretty different healthcare companies in different ways. And it seems that we're pretty bullish on both of them. Can you explain why that is?
Yeah, and I think the reason I wanted to highlight both of these as well is, as you mentioned, the kind of economic picture is darkening. And so healthcare, be it pet healthcare or human healthcare, tends to be very defensive in these sorts of times. So the companies I wanted to talk about are in the top five of our AIM 100 listing. And the first is HutchMed, which is a Hong Kong headquartered pharma group that is developing mostly oncology drugs. And I also then want to talk about the veterinary chain CVS, which has been having a little bit of a difficult time at the moment. So I'd argue that the bull case for both of these is slightly speculative, but as you said, for different reasons. I'll go into the bear cases in a minute, but start with the positives. HutchMed is really unique in terms of life sciences firms listed in London, in that the majority of its sales are in mainland China. It has some 13 cancer drug candidates at various stages of development at the moment. Three of these are already available, meaning they've been green-lighted by regulators and they're being used to treat patients. So it's quite impressive, really, that the company has gotten as far as it has. Oncology's a field dominated by huge blue-chip companies like AstraZeneca. Lots of smaller groups may think they've developed a promising new treatment but fail to get it past regulators and onto the market. And HutchMed is now partnering with companies outside of mainland China to bring its drugs to new populations. For instance, it has a partnership with the Japanese pharma company Takeda to bring one of its drugs to patients there. So even without an international expansion, it's an interesting story because we know rates of cancer go up as people live longer, and China now has one of the fastest growing aging populations in the world. As countries get richer, rates of certain cancers linked to lifestyle factors also increase. So it's kind of a compelling market opportunity, really. And then CVS is worth looking at because, as I kind of said earlier, pet care is known to be this really resilient sector. People will prioritise spending on the health of their pets when times are tough. And the company released full-year results in September, which we discussed on the podcast at the time about a month ago. And revenue was up 10%. Pre-tax profit was up 50%, which, are all good signs. But it's not as rosy as it might seem.
I mean, it did get a boost as well during the days of the pandemic and shortly afterwards. Whether that's been sustained, I don't know.
No, it has not been sustained for, obviously everyone got a pet in the pandemic, which was helpful to not just CVS, but also Pets at Home, which is the other kind of listed veterinary services group. But we've had this issue with the CMA, which is launching a review into the veterinary sector. It's not really known what's going to happen. It's really, they're assessing whether vets provide good value for money and a good service for pet owners. And that's in progress at the moment. But shares have really, shares of all or both veterinary companies have fallen. CVS is down actually even further than when we first discussed this. So it's down 13% in the last month. And that's all really on this kind of bearish feeling around what's going to happen with the CMA. But again, I would kind of caution investors not to panic as yet, because one, there's no evidence that there's going to be a huge profit impact, even if the CMA does impose some kind of new regulations on the sector. It's a wait and see thing, but also an opportunity potentially, because shares are very, very deflated at the moment.
So if those long-term investment rationale is in place for both companies, which it seems to be, even given sort of near-term challenges as well. Do you see any possibility that they could be subject to buyout provisions?
So it's difficult to speculate, and there have not been any buyout rumours for either company of late, but it is worth musing on for a second, I think, particularly as the company that was at the top of the AIM 100 last year, Abcam, has delisted from London, is still listed in New York and is currently being bought out, or at least there's a potential buyout process that's been initiated. Also worth noting with CVS, almost all of the country's veterinary chains are owned by private equity groups, and CVS is hovering obviously around this really low valuation at the moment. Dechra Pharmaceuticals, the veterinary drug maker, is currently being taken private by the private equity group EQT. So there's clear interest in this market. On the flip side, the private equity groups that sort of specialise in the vet services sector may want to see how things shake out with the CMA. With HutchMed, I would say it looks unlikely as they're going down this partnerships route. smaller biotechs, so other AIM-listed biotechs with one or two assets, are kind of buyout targets from bigger pharmaceutical companies. For instance, we've recently seen Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly buying out a lot of smaller drug makers with obesity drug candidates, not any off of the London market, but, you know, kind of throughout the world.
Good run for Eli Lilly of late.
It has been an incredibly good run for Eli Lilly of late. And yeah, they've clearly have the firepower to do this kind of buying out within the within especially obesity drugs. But we're, for other the other kind of model, as opposed to straight M&A in pharma, is this partnerships thing where a bigger company like Japan's Takeda, who I mentioned earlier, pays the smaller company, i.e. Hutchmed, to sell one of their drugs in a given geography. So they kind of bear the brunt of the marketing and the regulatory costs. Smaller companies often don't have the bandwidth to do this. And this seems to be working quite well for Hutchmed so far. I think they're placing a lot of kind of future growth hopes on partnerships. So, yes, it looks like that's the sort of future for that company. And the future for CVS is unknown. But again, the valuation is compelling.
Well, there we have it. There we have it. I mean, one takeaway, I guess, from this week's podcast is anyway, is that we are actually could be on the verge of seeing an increase in M&A activity, which ironically would be pretty good news for RWS, who we covered a little bit earlier on. But I think that's about it for this week. So I'd just like to say thanks to Julian, Gemma and Jennifer for their comments and say goodbye to everyone out there. Hopefully it's a profitable week for everyone and we'll speak to you again in a week's time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.